Three, two, one.
I think that if you only mourn the person for the good that you want to remember of, you're mourning a two-dimensional part of them. If you're thinking that this person is an idol and everything about them was perfect and they died by suicide, well, isn't that something to idolize as well? And that's dangerous. People expect somebody that if they have somebody who they love, who was the love of their life, die, that person should forever have no joy. And that makes no sense to me, because then not only one person has died in that situation, two people have died, even if the second person is still here on this earth.
Hey everyone, I'm Noor Taghori, and this is The Process. Hi everyone, and welcome back to The Process. Today we are talking about the process of dealing with grief, and I'm having this conversation with a good friend of mine, Anna Shinoda, who is an author and a senior advisor of the campaign Change Direction that focuses on changing the culture around mental health. This is a conversation that's going to be dealing with heavy topics around addiction, suicide, mental health in general, so I'm giving you this as a little bit of a warning, but I do think it's a really important conversation to tune into if you are ready to listen. For context, there is a person that we will be referencing in this interview if you're not familiar with, Chester Bennington, who was the lead singer of Linkin Park. Chester died by suicide a few years ago, and Anna is married to Mike Shinoda, who's also part of Linkin Park. So you're going to be hearing those names mentioned in this interview and conversation, so this is just for context, but we're going to be talking about a lot of different things across the spectrum of grief. So I hope you learn a lot. I hope you tune in, and welcome to The Process. I'm talking this whole time, prepping for this and like having these conversations, but I will say I'm very happy to be here with you, Anna. Thank you.
I'm so happy to have you here.
I'm so excited to like just be cozy with you and talk about something that I feel like you kind of have to be cozy to be talking about. But I guess for a little reference, do you remember the first time we met?
I'm not sure.
I was struggling to remember the first time. I was like, was the first time I met you at your house, or was it at the dinner?
You know what? You had met Mike at something.
The dinner with Bobby, yeah.
And then we invited you to a different dinner that we had with a whole group of people. And then you came over to our house afterward and like stayed until like
really
2 o'clock in the morning or something.
And
which Mike and I never stay up that late anymore because we have kids. So like we were just like, oh my gosh. But
oh my gosh, when is she leaving?
No, like you left and we were like, it's so late. How did this happen? How did it get so late? But that's, I think we just had a lot to talk about and a lot in common.
It was really special.
Yeah.
And
it was a really special night.
And I remember telling you, like, every time we come to your house now, it feels like home away from home.
Aww,
because you guys
I
have
love that.
It just, yeah, I appreciate it so much. And you've created like a space that's so comfortable to be able to actually open up and like talk about really vulnerable things, which is kind of what we're going into today, and like having a conversation about grief, which I was saying earlier to my team, I'm a little bit nervous about this, and not because like I'm so grateful it's a conversation with you because I know you, but I'm nervous about talking about the topic because it's something that's been on my mind a lot. I mean, we're in LA right now, and today is the like public memorial for Kobe Bryant, and that's actually what inspired this conversation, because you reached out to me about Kobe and like just the TMZ reporting and the response and like how people grieve a public figure, and you have you have experience with like grief over a public figure and then grief over private people and then the layers that yes. come with that. So yeah. I think like a great way to start this conversation is, how do you define grief?
I think that my definition of grief has changed because of the amount of grief that I went through. The year that Chester died was a really hard year. We had some family members got diagnosed with some diseases, and that was like a big impact on our life. And then Chester passed, and I think it was 4 months to the day after Chester passed, my mom passed. And up until that point, I think I kind of looked only at grief as the big grief. You know, and the big grief is when someone who you love deeply dies and they are gone. And I think though now, because I tend to like over research anything and everything. So of course, if like I'm going through something, I want to learn all about that thing.
Yeah.
So I think now, I actually looked up the definition of grief at one point, and it just says a deep sorrow. Now, it's a deep sorrow that's usually connected with death, but it's a deep sorrow. And so that really got me thinking about, like, I'm a parent, and when my kids go through something that seems something small to us, but it's a very deep sorrow for them, an example of that would be I was on tour with Mike, and we were staying at this hotel in Berlin. And my kids had, we were staying at this hotel, I think, for like a full month, maybe, or 3 weeks. My kids had their little loveys in their beds. And so they would sleep with these. And they're little stuffed animals that they've had since birth. And one night, we go to bed, and the loveys aren't in the bed. So we're like tearing up the place, trying to find it. They're nowhere. So I call housekeeping and I say, hey, can you guys check your sheets to see where the loveys are? Because at this point, the kids are now 100% screaming, crying, because the thing that they love, that they have slept with every single night since the day they were born, is gone. We are in another country. We're not even in our own beds.
Yeah.
And that was a moment of real grief for them. And so I'm trying to fix it, right? Because I'm a fixer. And I can't fix it because the laundry gets put into a train that goes to Poland, I believe. And then they do the laundry there, and then they send fresh sheets back. And that is how the laundry service is done at that hotel in Berlin. So they were like, no, you can't. And I was just like, I will get on the train and go to the laundry place right now. They were like, we will bring it back tomorrow. We've already let them know. They're going to find it for you. But my kids had to go through a night without their loveys. And so the thing that I did was, you know, I told them, I know you're very sad about this. It's going to be okay. And I then laid in the bed with each one of them until each one of them fell asleep. And then the next day the loveys came back. And so it's, you know, that's like the happy ending to the story. But that's a moment when it's a real grief for them. It's a real deep sorrow. And really, in those moments is when you start practicing for the big griefs of life. So what I had done is I said, I'm so sad for you. And I'm going to try and fix this, but then, okay, but then we have to accept it. And then I'm going to just be here for you. Mm-hmm. And then like the next day, by the way, we were like, the loveys can't be in the bed anymore. They have to be like in the morning, let's put them in a special place. So that way they don't end up going to Poland again. We learned something from that. And I think that in grief, the same way, if your experience is something bad happens and it gives you a deep sorrow, and then you have this experience of, okay, somebody is gonna, like, I can rely on somebody, I can go to a friend. So they're practicing, okay, my mom's gonna be there for me, she's gonna be here for me. And then the next day, having like a distraction and doing something else and kind of feeling, letting them feel joy again, even though they were, had this big grief and they had this big worry.
Yeah. Do you think that we like acknowledge from a young age, or should acknowledge at least, that there are these like little moments of grief that have us practice for the big one, so it's not as much of a shock? Or do you think that like as humans, the resilience we build in those moments like allows us to process what's happening?
I think that as parents, we should be aware of it, because like if you are somewhere with your kid and they let go of a balloon and suddenly they have this big moment of like, oh, I want that back. If your reaction is, it's okay, the balloon is gone, let me hold you, let me love you, and then let me distract you with something else that's joyful. Mm-hmm. That's a way of like training your child for a healthy way of moving through grief. Whereas if you say to them like, you're so stupid, you let the balloon go, you're teaching them to associate shame or guilt with grief. And I think that that's a really, really dangerous place to put somebody in, because if they keep associating those things with grief, then when the big grief comes, they're going to be either like blaming themselves or blaming others. And that's not a healthy place to be in those moments of big grief.
I would have never thought about the shame and the guilt that comes with that, because you, I mean, you know people, or you see, even the way that I feel like grief is portrayed in the media is like the person is, the transition of like loss comes from, or deals with like blaming yourself or blaming others or looking for an explanation or a reasoning. And like, I guess the thing that I've been trying to wrap my mind around is we've been on this planet for however many years as human beings, like death is the most common thing. It's the one guarantee for all of us. We've been living and dying for all of our existence. So why is it that we haven't figured out like the right way, if there is a right way, to deal with it and to process it? And then as humans who should be there to support each other, why are we not as familiar with like how we should be able to support each other to begin with?
I think that there are a couple of different levels going on with that, because first of all, I think that there is a romanticized version of grief that exists out there in a lot of stories. And that romanticized version is that you meet the love of your life and they die and you spend the rest of your life grieving that person and you're never the same and you never experience joy again.
Yeah.
And that is, we see it over and over again in movies, and to the point where I think people expect somebody that if they have somebody who they love, who is the love of their life, die, that that person should forever have no joy. And that makes no sense to me, because then not only one person has died in that situation, two people have died, even if the second person is still here on this earth.
How do we avoid losing ourselves though in that moment? Because there's like an imbalance in a person's life and world when you lose someone, and not just to death, but I mean, we've talked about this, like lose someone to, you know, in a divorce or in a breakup, or you've mentioned like when you're diagnosed with like a chronic illness, losing like a part of your body, or, you know, just there's so many angles to that. So how do you rebalance or recalibrate your life in that moment?
I think first of all, grief is like, it is a force. Like when it comes to you, you have to, I think like you have to respect that it's there. And, so like when Chester first died, the only thing I could really do for weeks was just like, kind of make sure that I was getting up in the morning, taking care of my kids, breathing hurt. Like my body like hurt.
Like physically
hurt. My heart actually felt like it was broken. I felt like I couldn't get deep breaths in, that they were all like at this super high, shallow place. I was crying constantly because I'm a crier anyway in real life. And then with that happening, I was like non-stop crying. So then I had all of the physical, like part of that, which is like the swelling and the eye swelling. And then there was, my brain was completely fogged over. I couldn't think. Reading has always been a comfort to me. I couldn't read because I would open the book and I would start reading down a page and I couldn't remember the sentence that I had just read. And so in that moment, it is, you just kind of have to like give into it and acknowledge it and be like, wow, this is what is happening right now. But when I say give into it and acknowledge it, I don't mean to sacrifice yourself to it. I mean like you kind of have to be like, okay, I'm going to go with this flow right now.
Isn't it like, it's almost like taking it minute by minute, taking it Absolutely. Day by day. Like that's what, where that saying comes from, because Absolutely. You have no other choice.
Yeah.
But in that moment, do you remember like ever telling yourself this is temporary?
I remember thinking, I will never know what happiness feels like again.
Wow.
Because the idea that I could be happy again after that happened was so far beyond what I was feeling in that moment. And so at first it was gathering with our friends. So we all went to Chester and Talinda's home and we gathered with everyone there. And there's this great book called Option B.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You and Talinda taught me about this concept. I'm excited to hear you talk about it.
It's really awesome. And I think it's like a guidebook to grief, and I always recommend that people read it if they're going through a big grief, especially. But there's this like bullseye that she has in there, and it talks about who gets taken care of and who do you take care of in that situation. So the very center of the bullseye would be like Chester's kids, and then the outer layer would be like Talinda and probably I would say like the guys in the band and maybe like his close family members. And then I would probably be in the third layer because I was closer to Talinda than I was to, you know, and then Talinda's closer to Chester. I'm closer to Mike than I was to Chester. So then you kind of start going out in the bullseye. So you help support the people who are more towards the center of the bullseye, and then you receive help from the people on the outside. So when I wasn't going down to visit Talinda and her kids, and I would, for the first week or so, I would go down and I would do story time with her kids before bed, and I would sit and I would read them stories. If I wasn't going there to help them, then I was at my home allowing people to come in and bring food and sit with me and let me cry and let me tell them how just, you know, trying to make sense of it all. And then as time passes, those people kind of start to dissipate because they are going on with their life, but we couldn't go on with our life. And part of that too, in option B, she's like, oh, return to work at least part-time because it's good for your brain and it's good to get back onto a schedule. Mike couldn't return to work because when Chester died, that part of his work died. We had the layers of grief with Chester's death were so profound because it started with, oh my gosh, one of our close friends has passed and also passed in suicide, which is, it's a different kind of grief because you are trying to also make sense of something that is unexplainable, really.
Yeah.
And then we had the grief of, oh my gosh, we have to cancel the tours and everything.
It was right before they were going on tour.
Yes. And they had to make the decision to cancel those tours, which of course, so there was the grief of like, oh, the rest of our year is now not what we thought it would be.
Yeah.
In that, then we realize, oh God, there are all these people on our crew who we've been working with, some of them for over 20 years, who now are out of work. The grief of realizing that you're a boss who cannot provide for your employees. Then there were all these other areas of the business that we had to shut down. There was an office called Machine Shop that had the charity Music for Relief within it, and then it had all these different areas of business. That office had to be shut down. All of the people, most of the people in that office had to be laid off. We could only keep like a few employees. So all of these things are happening, and each one of them is a huge amount of grief on its own. I mean, losing your job, that's a huge amount of grief. But losing your job and your friend and having to tell your employees, like, this is done, like, we cannot employ you anymore, it was brutal. And Mike is a really strong guy, and it was still incredibly brutal for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also the fact that, like, it's almost surreal, because if you're thinking about the music that is, like, revolved around your lives, mm-hmm. a lot of it talks about loss and suicide and really hard things. And so there's like this balance of like, this is the world that the employees and everybody like has been a part of, and yes. it's a movement
yes.
that people have been a part of. And it's just like, okay, so what happens now when the things that, you know, we've always, like, we enjoyed growing up, like, that were such, like, a distinct part of our lives. How do you almost, like, learn from that in the process of being able to heal?
I think it's not something that you consciously do, by the way.
Yeah.
I think that it is something that you... The things that helped Mike and I heal the most were things that we turned to, of course, having support of our friends, but then also, I'm a writer, so I wrote a lot of poems, and I would sketch. I do pencil drawings, so I would sketch. And there's so much power of a problem being like this huge, and then being able to take your feeling in that moment and bringing it down to just a piece of paper and the tip of that pencil. Mm. Because then it is, for that moment, manageable. So when I would sit and write a poem, or when I would sit and draw like a flower or somebody's dog, I drew so many people's dogs during that time, because it just like, you know, that brought me...
There was joy in that. Yeah.
So first of all, I was getting a relief in the moment from like all of the stuff that was floating around in my brain of, you know, questioning like how and why did this happen? But also the feelings of like, what are we going to do now?
Yeah.
You know, are we still going to be able to, travel the world with our kids? Are we still going to, can Mike still do music? Can I still be a writer? I couldn't even think enough to read a sentence. Am I going to ever be able to write a book again?
Wow.
So there's all that going on, but having that one moment of like, okay, I'm having that moment of relief.
Mm.
And then when you start transferring that to other things, like, you know, having a conversation with a friend, and then suddenly in the conversation, you're not talking about Chester, you're not talking about my mom after she yeah. died, and you're not talking about the grief. And then suddenly you're talking about something else, and then you laugh for the first time. When you laugh for the first time, by the way, your feeling is like, oh, that felt great. And then immediately right after, a feeling of like, I shouldn't be laughing. I should not be laughing because this terrible thing happened.
Like, but who, like, where does that come from? Like, is that on us as a society? Like,
I think maybe that's on us as a society. But I think it's partially on that. I think it's partially, I mean, maybe for me personally, it is how I was raised.
Mm.
I don't know.
But I think a lot of it, like, I think at least with cultures and things that I'm familiar with, I mean, there's always a point of grieving. We have, like, as Muslims, I think it's like maybe 3 days, like, or we like have a funeral immediately after and stuff. And then there's like this huge, you know, just idea of like death is transitional, like you're going into something else and this is temporary and you find that. And I think like almost celebrating life through art or poetry or however you express yourself is like really important. There's actually one poem of yours that really just resonated with me, which I would love if you read, is Lavender.
So this book, what Mike was doing with his grief was he was doing paintings and writing music, and I was writing poems. And when it came time for him to release Post Traumatic, which was his songs about his grief and with his artwork about his grief, he had read my poems and he said, can I include some of these in here? And I said yes. He originally wanted to do like a whole series of poems, but his album is about the process of grief. And if you listen to it from start to finish, it's about going through it and then coming out on the other side and having joy.
Yeah.
Okay. So my poems, he read through all of them and he's like, you don't have any happy poems. So we only put 3 of the poems in here
because I didn't
have any that went into that space of joy.
I felt like there's one poem you wrote about resilience. Right. That's really...
I may not have written that by the time he was putting this out. Okay. That may have come later.
We can read that one later too.
So this is Lavender. I hope you haunt us. I hope your presence fills the room long after the momentum of tragedy ends. I hope your voice takes us off guard in those everyday moments. I hope it comes in the form of a song and silence. As encouragement to write this poem in this moment, as nonsensical words dropped after we wake from a dream. I hope you haunt us with lavender, fields of lavender or a few along the path, bringing peace through scent and the steady hum of busy bees. Or a single stem, not even in full bloom, barely recognizable, but still lavender.
I love that so much. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that?
I'll tell you a little bit about it. It was maybe less than a week after Chester died that I wrote this. And I had dropped my kids off at the day camp they were going to. And it was really important. My kids were little at the time. They were 6 and 8. And it was really important for me to keep them in their moments of joy. And so part of that was having them still go to day camp that they love and be around people, you know, be around their friends that they loved. And not having them have to watch me just deal with this grief. So I dropped my kids off at their day camp. And then I was supposed to go over and sit with Talinda for a little bit. And she said, oh, I have a meeting that I have to do with some, you know, and when somebody dies, oh my God, the amount of paperwork and things that you need to handle immediately when you are in no place to have to handle those, that type of thing is, it's just really overwhelming.
How is there not a system that alleviates that, like, in place, though?
I don't know. Like, for when my mom passed, my brother and I did all those things for my dad, so he wouldn't have to do it. But, you know, a lot of it fell on Talinda when Chester passed. Mm-hmm. And she did have, you know, some people were helping with different things with like setting up the service.
A lot of people don't have that. And it's still like something you have to deal with.
And if you don't, then you just have to deal with it on your own, which is, it's a lot. And it's also a lot for you to have to, I mean, you're signing forms and reading things and like your brain isn't even working well.
Right.
So it's a lot. But when I wrote this poem, she called me and she said, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be at the house for a while. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I called a friend of mine and I said, can I just come over to your house? I said, can we meet for coffee? She said, no, I can't, but you can come over to my house. And I said, okay. And so I walked in to her front door and she has all these lavender plants on either side. And I was walking through, and it was such like a beautiful summer day. And the lavender was still, it was still kind of in bloom. But, you know, it kind of had like gone past its time. So this, it wasn't like fully, but you could still smell it. And the bees were like around the lavender. And it was such a stark contrast of walking through that beautiful garden in this moment when I wasn't feeling joy, to kind of see that much life happening in this garden. And then when I got home later that day, I wrote this poem.
You mentioned the momentum of tragedy passing, and that's something I don't think that I think occasionally we think about it, but it's like, I compare it to Twitter. I'm like, how long, like Kobe Bryant, who's one of the biggest like legends in the entire world, passes away and it's trending on Twitter and stuff. And I'm like, somebody of that caliber as a public figure, like how long is he gonna be trending for? Because it's easy to talk about it in social media terms, but like that momentum doesn't last that long. And all you can do at that point is think about like the family and friends who the momentum doesn't ever really go away. Like it's there for a really long time. So when we talk about like the momentum of tragedy passing as people who are not in the center of that tragedy, how do we be supportive?
So one thing first that I wanted to talk about Twitter and trends when it Twitter and trends when
Twitter.
It comes Twitter when it comes to grief is it is always a really weird place to be.
So weird.
On a day that somebody has passed away, because it will be literally like a tweet, like it's almost like people feel like they have to drop their obligatory like rest in peace.
Yeah, and I'm like
tweet, and then their next tweet could literally be like, I just got this great lip gloss, oh my god. Like
I think it's really weird.
And it's really weird and it's really hard. I actually can't be on social media on those days.
Yeah.
Because it's really weird to think how quickly.
Because it feels like people just move on so fast, and it's not like you're even moving on. I mean, think about the way that we monitor social media of the family members and the friends and stuff. Like, everybody waits for the statement to be released.
That's right.
And then you wait to see how long after the statement is released, a normal photo is posted or a normal tweet. And then you assume, because this is like all we know about social media, because it is a facade of like, it's a creation of a reality that doesn't really exist, but you assume because they posted a normal photo, they're healed.
Right. And then if you post a normal photo, the comments are, how dare you? Or like, yay, it's great. I'm so glad that you're doing well. Well, maybe in that moment we were doing well. I remember that as a band, we decided to take all of our families to Hawaii.
Yeah, I saw,
because we were supposed to be on tour with all of our kids. So our kids were expecting that they were going to get to spend the summer together like they had for their whole lives. Because that's how it worked. We would go out on summer tours and all of our kids would spend that summer together. And suddenly it's like, no, you're not gonna be able to see your friends. Mm. Like this isn't, so we decided to go to Hawaii instead. And Talinda made the decision to post a photo of us on the beach.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was, a friend of hers had given us those like beach cover-ups as a gift. And she posted it and then people were just like, you know, doesn't look like the grieving widow to me. And it was just so like, oh my God. Like she posted that picture as a thank you to her friend who designed and made those and gave them to us. And she posted that picture as a like, hey, we're out on the beach. Like, hey, we're doing okay, right? Like
We're trying.
And was immediately judged for it. Harshly judged for it. And that's really, I mean, like I don't wish that anybody could have been in those other moments where, you know, she was like so completely devastated that I had to like lay in bed until she fell asleep with her. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want anybody to be in that moment with us because that was a really, really hard moment. But at the same time, that's not the moment that we're going to be showing on social media.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that they're like, I mean, so yeah, let's transition to this conversation about the balance of, you know, what is the difference between grieving a public figure mm-hmm. and grieving a private person? And I'd like to actually open up this conversation by having you read one of your poems about this, okay. Grief Poacher,
okay.
Because then we'll go into the nitty gritty. So I will grab the poem.
Yeah. So I'll read this poem and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what was going on before then. So this poem is called Grief Poacher. You don't know that minutes before you took this picture, we sat together in a crowded restaurant, out together for lunch for the first time since it happened. You don't know that we sat side by side at the sushi bar, trying to have a moment of normal, relieved that we didn't see anyone we knew, that no one came up to offer their condolences, their reminders, their fresh spikes that come with well-meaning compassion. You don't know that we talked about how tired we were of being sad all the time, about how we wanted to force joy to appear again, that having lunch out was so foreign, so anxiety-ridden, so needed. You didn't know that we wished we could go where the world didn't know, where we could just escape reality and pretend, just pretend to have fun for a while. You don't know that as we left the restaurant, we felt relief that we could go out without incident. You don't know that we were talking about our son when I spotted you filming, that I stopped mid-sentence. You don't know that your actions make our grief worse, add another layer, another barrier. Or maybe you do, but you don't care. All we could do was keep walking toward our car, toward you. All you had to do was wait and get that photo and get that video and get that paycheck. So I wrote that after the first time that Mike and I went out in public, which was, I think, 2 full weeks after Chester died. And the reason why we hadn't been out in public up until that point was because we had paparazzi just sitting outside of our neighborhood waiting to get a picture of Mike grieving, like getting the first picture of him grieving. I'm going to do like a compare and contrast for you because since my mom died 4 months after Chester died, I had 2 vastly different grieving situations that happened in a very short period of time. So the morning that Chester died, normal summer morning, dropped the kids off at camp. Mike was supposed to be at a photo shoot. I'm sitting on my couch in my office playing a video game because the kids are off at camp and it is summer and I'm playing a video game. And I hear the garage door open. And I was like, this is weird. And at the same time, I get a text from one of the other wives of one of the other bandmates. And she says, I'm devastated. And I text her back, what's going on? And she doesn't reply. So I've gotten this text and I hear the garage door open and I know something is deeply, deeply wrong. And Mike comes in the room and he says, come on, let's go talk. And I'm like, Mike, what's going on? And immediately I went to Chester's family. I said, is Talinda okay? He said, yes. I said, are the kids okay? He says, yes. I didn't ask about Chester because in my heart, I knew that that was probably what it was. And I knew that because we had watched Chester struggle with addiction and with depression and with just a lot of health and mental health issues for many years. And we had tried to help so many times. And sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. And we just kind of had to be at peace of like, we're trying our best to help our friend. And as we were like, I just couldn't, I couldn't ask though about him, because I just kind of knew, like, oh my God, is this the worst case scenario that I've been worried about forever? And Mike sat down and told me. And first of all, the sounds that came out of me were not human. They were animal. I don't even know. I could never replicate that again. I don't even know. But it was like, that was the sound of grief. And the sound of shock and the sound of disbelief. And then when I calmed down enough, the first call I made was to my therapist, because I had to talk to her about my own mental health. But I also had to ask her, like, how do I tell my kids about this? And so I had a brief call with her, because I knew that we were short on time. So then I called my best friend and I told her what happened. And I called my dad and my mom and I told them what happened. And that was it. Those are the calls that I got to make. And then I knew that the news was out, because my cell phone started dinging and people started calling. And it was, I couldn't even make a call if I wanted to, because of all of the text messages and all of the phone calls coming in. So I literally just had to put my phone on silent and walk away. So my family found out from, you know, my brother found out from somebody. They walked in and they said, hey, the guy from Linkin Park just died. And my brother, of course, like, freaked out, because he thought, which one?
Yeah.
So we weren't given the opportunity to make the phone calls. And I know that there were some of even Chester's, like, family that didn't get a phone call before it came out. And many of his friends that didn't get a phone call before it came out. Because the gossip websites were so quick to put this information out in the world that we didn't even get to contact our loved ones and his loved ones. And also, while this is going on, in that type of situation, like, management had to, Chester's house didn't have a gate in front of it. So they had to, like, get a temporary fence put up in front of the house. They had to make sure, you know, Talinda and the kids were still in Arizona, because that's where they had been vacationing with Chester before he died. And they had to get her home to her home. They had to deal with, okay, we have to try and get a statement together. There's all these things that they had to do. And the most important thing when you are given news like that is to be able to give the news and receive the news in a compassionate way.
Yeah.
And so, for example, when my mom passed, my dad called and the paramedics were there, and I was my mom's medical power of attorney. So I was on the phone with my dad and I was comforting him, and I had to tell the paramedics her information for her DNR is on the refrigerator, so go get that. And I knew what her wishes were. And by the way, something that people do not do in our culture, and you absolutely need to do it, is talk to your loved ones about death. You got to talk to them about it. You've got to know, like, what if there was a terrible accident and I'm on life support? What are your wishes? You know, because what are my wishes? What would your feelings be about that? Like, we're a couple. Like, let's have a conversation about this. Or as a child to your parents, what do you really want? Because in this world, if you don't say specifically what your wishes are, they're going to try and keep you in this world. And my mom was, she was in her late 70s, and she was ready. She was ready to move on. And so after I got off the phone with my dad, I called my brother, and we talked, and we kind of shared a few stories about our mom, and then we talked about, okay, who's going to take care of dad? He was going to take the first week. I was going to take the second. So, you know, he went and he took care of my dad. And then I called my other siblings. We made plans on, okay, who's going to call my mom's sisters? Who's going to call my mom's brothers?
Yeah.
Like, all of that type of stuff. And then Mike and I went on, we had planned to go up to the mountains with our kids, because that was Thanksgiving week. And so we still went to the mountains. And I had a week of, like, reflection and walks and hikes and time with my family and with my kids, while I was also planning my mom's memorial service Getting my dad, making sure my dad was okay. So in contrast, Chester dies. The first day is just overwhelming. We can't even leave our neighborhood because paparazzi is set up right outside the neighborhood. I'm having other people drop off and pick up my children, so I'm not even in a car going anywhere. And then Mike and I did leave to go be with Talinda and the other bandmates and Chester's friends and family at his home.
But what about, like, what is it about our culture that, like, needs to change in order to protect and be compassionate mm-hmm. towards one another and see all humans as human first?
Well, first of all, I think, so there's an interesting thing that goes on with our brains and with celebrities. And one is that you see them over and over and over again. So you start thinking that you know them, mm-hmm. even though you don't really know them. But then also, I think that people don't see them as 100% real humans, mm-hmm. and they are real humans. And so when a death like that happens, it becomes, there's a couple things going on. People really want to know the details. But there's also like an entertainment value to death. Mm-hmm. And that's really where it gets into like a bad situation, I think, is the entertainment value of death. And the thing is that these websites that put up the photos and they are, Chester's like autopsy was.
Yeah.
Let's talk about being also respectful of him. And right. of his death, that was his body and his death. And that is a very private information that somebody decided, no, I'm going to put that up on my website. So that way I get money from people clicking through.
Right.
And so the only thing that I can say with like changing the culture, like step in front of your curiosity and say like, I don't need to see this.
Right.
I don't need, what good does it do if I see this information? Yeah. What good does it do if I see the remnants of a car crash or, you know what I mean? Like it actually isn't doing any good. If anything, it's
hurting.
Causing trauma for you. And it's a complete invasion of privacy of the person who has died and their loved ones.
Step in front of your curiosities.
Step in front of your curiosity.
I love that. One thing you've mentioned before is the importance of grieving a person as a whole.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
So I think that a lot of times when someone passes, our first like feeling is like, I want to only remember this person for the good that they did. And I had a really complicated relationship with my mom, and I loved her very much, but I also had a lot of, it was just very complex, our relationship. And so when she died, I started going into like a full panic attack that night. I'd written like a poem about her passing, and then I decided to post it on my Instagram. And then I was like, oh my God, what did I do? Why am I posting that on my Instagram? And then like, I was just a mess. And I went into like a panic attack, and I was thinking of all these wonderful memories of my mom. And I think that it's healthy to think of like wonderful memories of your mom. But then I was forgetting about the complicated part of the relationship. And the way that Mike actually calmed me down that night was by telling me like, hey, let's not forget all of your mom. Let's not forget, you know, some of the things that she said and did
Why
that were hurtful.
Why is it important to do that though?
Because I think that if you only mourn the person for the good that you want to remember of, you're mourning a two-dimensional part of them. You're not mourning the full person. And so I don't think that you can fully move through the grief unless you mourn everything. Good memories, the bad memories, the whole thing. And that's not to say, I don't want to say like, let's speak ill of the dead, but I want to say, let's remember that everybody is a human. They all make mistakes. We really idolize celebrities that die young and tragically. And I think that starts to get very dangerous especially when we get into like drug overdoses or suicides, because if you're thinking that this person is an idol and everything about them was perfect and they died by suicide, well, isn't that something to idolize as well? And that's dangerous, because Chester was very human and he was very complicated and he was an addict. And let me tell you, he was, I said in my poem after he died, he was love, magic, and joy, but he was also those moments and those behaviors when he was using. I don't like to think about those things, but that was part of who he was. And it's better to think about him as this whole complex human being and be able to mourn both the good and the bad.
Us outside of the public figure and like more on the private person level though, what would your response be to people who are just like, well, what's the point of remembering? If you had a complicated relationship with a parent or a sibling or whoever it is that you're dealing with their loss, and not just the loss of death, like the loss of the relationship or the loss of the idea of the person, all of those things, like what good does it do for you to remember those moments in the grieving process? Like how is that healing?
I think if you don't, then it's almost like you're not grieving reality. Does that make sense? And so how are you to move on with your own reality if you aren't like grieving the whole and complete person? And you can't, the other thing too, when I wrote Learning Not to Drown, I was trying to like work through my own emotions about finding out that my brother, who is somebody who I loved very much, by the way, I'm the youngest of seven. So when I say my brother, there's like, it could be one of four, right? he was found guilty of a sex offense, and I was trying to come to terms with like, how could this person who I know, who like taught me to ride a bike and wrote me all these beautiful letters and would draw Garfield for me all day long. Like, how is this person the same person who did this terrible thing? And there was a lot of grief with me trying to figure out that. But the only way that I could grieve losing him as the idealized brother was saying he was a whole person, a whole complete person. And then I was able to like grieve the end of that relationship and say like, okay, he's not what I thought he was, but he is. Does that make sense? Like he still was that great brother to me, but he also was this other thing.
I don't even know if there's an answer to like how to deal with, you're talking, like, we're in a time now where people are coming forward about sexual assault more than they ever have before, and I've never put a lens of grief and loss on that, but as someone who's experienced that, like, I can completely understand and see where you come from that, but, like, it's so hard to wrap your mind around somebody that you love also doing something, because it almost becomes like two different people. And so are you grieving both people or are you grieving?
But you have to grieve them as one whole person though. Like you can't, separate somebody. You can't separate them. Like they are a whole person. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And what's the answer to seeing someone as a whole person when there are parts of them you never knew?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's messy. I think like specifically with my brother in that situation, like I wrote a whole book about the grief that came with that. I didn't know that that's what I was writing at the time. I know that it helped me significantly through the trauma of finding out that information. And it wasn't until later that I was like, huh, why did that help? And it's actually when you experience something traumatic, your brain doesn't have full memories. It has like these little sparks of memories, right?
Yeah.
In my book, I describe it as like spinning pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that never quite fit together. Ugh. And when you write, which this is like something with grief that I think is really important, whether you're grieving the loss of a relationship or something like me with my brother or with me with my family, when you're grieving, If you are able to do something mm-hmm. artistic with it, that's great.
Yeah.
If you're able to write, if that's something that works for you, it's really good because your brain wants to keep coming back to the trauma over and over and over again because it's not making sense, not making sense. Then you write a story about it, or maybe you write your own experience and you say, these are the things I learned, or you write your own experience. You say, I'm going to write my own experience and now I'm going to change the ending. Okay? You do that and suddenly your brain has a complete story. And a lot of times it can kind of let that trauma rest because without the complete story, your brain doesn't want to rest.
How does gratitude play a role in maintaining your resilience okay. in these moments?
Gratitude is key. First of all, before my kids go to bed every night, we have our little tuck-in routine.
Yeah, I've been there for one
yes.
of those.
So you know, we asked two questions. It was, what was your favorite part of the day?
Yeah.
And what are you grateful for? And when Chester died, and I have a little like gratitude journal that I keep next to my bed, and I try and write down three things yep. a day that I'm grateful for. When Chester died, like that night, I was like, I'm not grateful for fucking anything right now. Like, I was not grateful at all. Yeah. But then I had to be like, no, I've got to do it. And so it was, I'm grateful for running water. Mm. I'm grateful for my kids. I'm grateful for Mike. Like,
those were the three things for that night.
That was it. Yeah. That was the three things for that night. Because I really, it was really hard to come up with something. Because on a good day, you might be like, I'm grateful that, like, today, you know.
It's either about your day.
Yeah.
Or, like, the things that, I mean, and having that gratitude journal is so important, too, because it physically rewires your brain mm-hmm. yeah. to, like, notice and look for those things. And, I mean, I'm grateful for you today.
Oh, I'm grateful for you, too.
So I want to wrap up this conversation in two ways. One, I always like to ask people, how is your heart doing today and after this conversation?
This morning, my heart was really nervous because talking about this, first of all, I know that I'm talking about something that is big and complicated.
Yeah.
And I feel like I know from my experience, like there's not a right way or a wrong way to grieve,
yep.
right? But I know from my experience, like if you can take the bad and make it into something good, and that was like the poems, the art. Anybody can be creative in those moments, even if it's like making like a memory box. Some
yeah.
people do memory boxes. But just being able to take like something terrible and turn it somehow into something beautiful, there's a lot of power in that. And that's what worked for me and for Mike. But I think that... obviously what worked for us doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
And then I feel like, oh, I'm sitting down talking about grief. I'm not like I don't have a doctorate in
grief. I think that's
grief.
Why this was so special and important to me though,
yeah.
because it was like, I think it's a lot more raw and personal and mm-hmm. easy, more relatable. I would love if you could read your poem on resilience because okay. I felt that moment towards the end of your poem.
So before I read this, first of all, a note about resilience that I think I have more thoughts about it since I wrote this poem.
Oh.
But yeah, you're like, ooh, what's this?
Yes.
Surprise! I think that resilience has a lot to do with harvesting those teeny tiny moments of joy that you have.
Mm.
So in like when the worst is happening, if you can find a moment of joy and say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and feel that and allow myself to feel that and like harvest that, then you make kind of like a little like brick, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is my little brick of joy. And then maybe you work on a poem and it feels good and you're able to be like, okay, this is another brick of my poem or brick of like resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start laying those down and pretty soon you have a foundation.
Mm.
Because when something terrible happens, you've got nothing, so you kind of have to start from foundation again. And then you're able to like stand on that foundation and it's like a foundation of courage, but it's also a foundation of joy and of the things that you did to help get yourself back. Okay. So I wrote this. This is resilience. And I wrote this actually about Talinda and about her resilience. So
does she know about this poem?
Maybe.
You're like, wait.
I don't know if she does.
She does now.
I don't think she would be saddened by me sharing this.
Oh, no. I was just curious as to know, like, because I... Mm-hmm.
I think there was one day when we were in Hawaii that I was laying in bed with her and I was reading the poems that I'd written. And I believe that I'd already written half of this. And then I added the ending to it because it was
obviously
off about later. Yeah. When death came to her home, she did not run. She stayed. She stayed as she had before when addiction threatened her love. She stayed and she grieved. Even in those first hours when she could barely find breaths, she stayed, filling her home with love, with life, with friends and family, with the things death could not rule, could not control. She stayed because her home was a temple of their love and death had no rights to take that away. She stayed until she was ready, until her children were ready. Then she left on her terms, locking away the residual heaviness, stepping into a new home that felt like you had designed it just for them. So that was what I had written for her.
What do you want people to take away about resilience from this in any moment?
I think that people should remember that in the big, terrible moments, it is definitely all of the small moments that makes you it doesn't just help you through, but it changes you, right?
Yeah.
And in these big moments of grief and tragedy, those are moments that start to kind of like redefine who you are. And I can tell you that if you aren't able to deal with it like in a healthy way, that you could get stuck in the grief, or you can get stuck in the tragedy. And so I really think that the importance of, like, you know, you make these little moments, you make your new foundation of resilience, and then you move forward in life knowing more, and you move forward in life knowing that there are so many things out of our control. But even in those moments when so many things are out of our control, there are still these tiny things that are in our control.
Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the light in the conversation. I appreciate you. I learned so much.
This episode was produced by myself, Alice Cottle, Lindsay Blum, Hannah Park, Adam Kafif, audio and sound engineering by Seth Feingersh and Jeff Pace. Creative direction by Shawnee Pleasance. Video shot by Ryan Kane Fitzgerald and edited by Tom Huerta. This episode soundtrack was brought to you by Portugal the Man. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, then talk to a stranger today and let us know what that process was like. You can do so by hitting me up on social media. All of my handles are at N-O-O-R, except for Twitter, which is N-T-A-G-O-U-R-I. Yes, I have a last name. And if you're in the US or Canada, you can text me at the number 301-246-8894. Yes, it's really me. I can't wait to hear about your experiences. And of course, don't forget to subscribe.